And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. We're devoting some time this week to the sitcom actress as we say goodbye to one of the very best. We'll talk about Mrs. C and Mrs. Bunker and some other classics, and perhaps we'll look at some current examples as well. We'll also visit the funny pages and turn our attention to the ones that we've loved and not loved and just plain lost track of. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and that sort of thing for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, Trey and Glenn, I'm very happy to have you back. We will once again thank Gene Demby and Kat Chow, who were here last week.
Yes, we will. They did a great
job. Amazing things.
Our dear pals, they were terrific.
Trey just admitted that he doesn't listen to our show.
Yeah. I was in Paris. Like, I listened to your show.
You couldn't walk along the, I don't know, what's a French landmark? And heard our voices?
Do you know what bandwidth costs?
Any hoodle. Well, that was fun. So as we tape this, it is Monday, and on Friday, Jean Stapleton, who played Edith Bunker, passed away. She was over 90.
She had a good run.
Pretty long-lasting lady, had a good run. Led to a lot of lovely tributes, including one that Susan Stamberg wrote for the blog today, which was very lovely, a memory of participating in a theatrical extravaganza with Jean Stapleton that I recommend all of you read. But we thought it would be a good time to talk about sitcom actresses, perhaps especially wives, but maybe some other women as well. Glenn, you presented us with a long list of women that you thought were fascinating in this category. Do you have Edith Bunker specific thoughts?
Well, sure. I mean, she belongs to the sitcom tradition of the dingbat, the dumb character who actually is wise in other ways. But she didn't start out like that. She was based on a character from the British sitcom that All in the Family was based on, Till Death Do Us Part. And that character, in the UK version, was kind of feisty, very bitter about her lot in life, and she fought back with the Archie Bunker stand-in. So it seems to me that Edith belonged originally to the tradition of the flighty, dumb wife from, like, the Gracie Allen and George Burns.
Sure.
In a way, the I Love Lucy, who is not necessarily flighty, but certainly was wild.
But also sort of a counterweight, kind of a foil, kind of a making that larger-than-life male character warmer by virtue of his connection to her.
Yeah, there was a lot of analysis that talked about how Archie Bunker could never have been a successful character without that woman whose affection for him had to explain something about him.
Right, right. I think that's right. And they were sort of legendarily very nervous about that character and about that show, and it ran with a disclaimer when it started about sort of like, this is just a lighthearted show. We hope to cast some light on these things.
He's not the mouthpiece through which we speak.
Well, exactly. Yeah. It was sort of like, we don't necessarily agree with him. Right, we are just making a comedy that we hope will raise interesting issues.
Sure.
They actually ran it with a disclaimer. So.
And Edith Bunker was created by Norman Lear, this ultra-left-wing liberal guy, in the 70s, in the time of feminism and women's lib. And she represented the unquestioning loyalty. She was kind of subservient to Archie in a way. But let me put it this way. There have been two clips that everybody's kind of sent around about Edith Bunker, like the Jean Stapleton in this role. The first comes from season 6, an episode called Edith Breaks Out, which is where she stands up to Archie by saying she wants to work a volunteer job that he's forbid her to work.
Edith, that was an order.
I ain't taking no orders.
You ain't what?
I ain't taking no orders. I can be a sunshine lady if I want to be. And I want to be. And I am!
And then the second moment that a lot of people point to is this moment where in the 8th season, she defends herself from a potential rapist by throwing a burnt birthday cake, her own 50th birthday cake, into his face. Now, you could just break out into response groups with the symbolism of that.
That really is an entire
women's study seminar
right
there. But those moments, because when you take a look at that scene where she's fighting off the potential attacker, she plays it so real that the audience has no idea what to do with it, because there are little comic moments here and there, but it's just too real.
I've always really admired that episode because it's so strange and unsettling. And because it was so unusual at that time, it would still be unusual now. Mm-hmm. But I think it was even more unusual then to suggest that rape might happen to an older woman where it did not appear to be motivated as it is not actually motivated by someone thinks you're so hot that that is why this happens.
Yeah.
And I think the first really interesting revolutionary thing about that is it's a very, very plain upending of the traditional idea that people had about sort of mashers. You know what I mean? That it was this was rape as violence and violation, and her need to defend herself was different from what you would have seen to the degree you saw rape storylines, which I think there weren't very many anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there were probably some in soaps, but other than that, I don't think there were a lot of them anyway. But that I've always loved that episode just because it's so odd.
Right.
And it's so, as you say, the comedy is mixed in with these really scary, I mean, it's legitimately very scary.
Well, and to have that serious threat, that very visceral threat posed to the character who is clearly the soul of the show.
Right.
Right.
That she is the center of this solar system of people who are much more sort of there to be mouthpieces for issues.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, the Rob Reiner character and the Carol O'Connor character and you know,
Sammy Davis Jr.
The solar system metaphor is a really good one because without Edith, that gaggle of characters would have had no reason to hang together.
Right.
She was the one they all had in common, right? They could never have stood each other.
Well, and you have to have, you know, a show like that has to have heart.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very much the heart of that show.
Yeah.
And I think, as Glenn pointed out, she started off in that dingbat tradition, but it became very clear that she had made certain decisions about the fact that her biggest priority was preserving her family and keeping everybody together. And she wasn't dumb. She was just kind of, you know, she would miss the point of certain conversations. But the genuine affection that was between those two characters, starting from the performance of the theme song, is really how, I think, as Trey pointed out, you stay connected to him. Because in an episode like that rape episode, you know that the other thing that's coming is her telling him, is her having a conversation with him about it. And how, you know, there were many episodes in which he cared for her and anything serious, you know. And there were a couple where she had, I think, medical issues and
she had her death.
And
there's another relatively famous episode where she comes to the defense of a school teacher who Archie figures out at a cocktail party that the school teacher is having is in a relationship with another woman.
Mm-hmm.
And he likes them just fine. But he decides that he needs to let somebody know because that's inappropriate for a teacher. And Edith sort of navigates that situation in a way that sort of opens his eyes, as often happened on that show.
Right.
So Edith represents one of sitcom wife, mother.
I mean, certainly more than a type, but yes, one variety.
So what are some others?
Well, the tension between a person who works in the home and wanting to get out of the home in some way goes back far time. I mean, the engine of I Love Lucy was Lucy wants to be in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Ricky wants to keep her out of the show because he wants to keep her out of the show. Not because she's not good, not because she's not funny, not because she doesn't make the show better, because he wants to keep her out of the show. And later on, much later on in the run of that series, there was an episode, this is after Little Ricky, where she kind of says, I think housework is boring.
Listen, girl, once you start working, you'll find out that it's just as humdrum and boring as being a housewife.
Nothing is as humdrum and boring as being a housewife.
Yeah. Besides, what makes you so sure you can even get a job?
I didn't have any trouble getting a job as a housewife.
Well, that was only because the boss was in love with you.
Oh, fiddle faddle.
You don't know how good you got it.
Oh, sure, I got it great.
Now, this is like in the 50s to hear this happen. And then, of course, at the same time, you've got June Cleaver, who vacuums the carpet in pearls and heels.
Uh-huh.
You've got Laura Petrie a little bit later, who for the first time, I don't think June Cleaver ever got her own storyline. I don't think any of these other sitcom moms got their own storylines because it was about the kids.
Right.
But she actually was a character in and of herself who helped drive some of these plots.
And as they discovered, I've been reading, as I mentioned on the show a couple weeks ago, a book about the history of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And one of the things they talk about with Mary Tyler Moore is that as they used her on the Dick Van Dyke Show, she really brought comedy to that character that wasn't necessarily baked into it, that right. as they began to discover it, they would then, you know,
develop it.
They would then develop it as she brought it to the character. And I think one transition that happened at some point was from sort of the subservient wife who was secretly kind of had the guy's number, right? The honeymooners, obviously.
Sure, absolutely.
As well. The honeymooners, the Edith Bunker type of woman, although those two women are very different, but they have in common the idea that
there's a blustery male figure.
They considered themselves traditional wives to a blustery male figure, but secretly they had the guy's number the whole time. Later, I think sitcom wives took a turn in the direction of sort of sometimes the risk was that they were going to be the no person.
Right.
They were going to be the scold a little bit.
Dad wants to feed the kids whipped cream and pennies.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
you know, mom swoops in and
right.
and fixes things.
And the question is always whether you can find a balance. Is that going to come off like the mom is just a scold? Or are you going to find something like they did? I always thought one of the more successful elements of Home Improvement
uh-huh.
was that they found a dynamic between that couple where she did have to do a lot of telling him no, and
right.
she did have to do a lot of telling him to chill out. The Cosby Show was actually the same mm-hmm. way. She did have to do a lot of telling him no, but they found genuine affection where it wasn't scoldy because
mm-hmm.
especially on Home Improvement, I always liked the fact that she would laugh when he was being, sometimes when he was being over the top and crazy, but she also existed as kind of this grounding influence.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those parts are limited / limiting.
Mad About You walked this line a little bit, where in the beginning they seemed like equal partners, and then as they sort of ossified into their roles,
yeah.
Paul became the happy-go-lucky guy, and Jamie became the scold.
Yeah.
But they still tried to keep it on some measure of balance, although there were several episodes, and they did this intentionally, where you didn't feel they liked each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I think a lot of those roles are harder than they look. The acting on, particularly the ones where the wife has to, really is supporting a central male character. But Mad About You, I think, was conceived a little more as a pairing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whereas a show like Home Improvement or something
yeah.
like that is really built around
right,
the
built
guy,
around the star,
and then
yeah.
they add the wife, and you want the wife to be awesome, which she is.
And that's one thing that I wanted to touch on was sort of the different perspectives that these shows themselves are coming at. If the central member of the cast, if the central story being told
right.
is the man's story, the woman's story, the couple's story, or mm-hmm. in the case of like Malcolm in the Middle,
sure.
the kid's story.
Right. Yeah.
And or even The Simpsons, where even Marge's hair is based on Matt Groening, when he was a kid, looked up and her hair seemed 6 feet tall because
right.
that was his impression of her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so a lot of these views of women, the views of these wives and mothers is sort of based on what perspective the show is coming from. So you have like a Roseanne where it's her.
I was wondering
mm-hmm.
how long it was going to be before we talked about Roseanne because
right.
that's such a different show. And I know that
yeah.
you guys are huge fans of it. Not that I wasn't. I just wasn't as big a follower as you guys were. But yeah, Roseanne is such a different way of telling the story of a nuclear family and the woman who is essential to it, right?
It's one of the few, and I'm sure there are others, and I'm sure people will remind us of them, you know, as soon as they
yeah,
hear
yeah.
this
one,
conversation.
One of the few where the wife can
right.
be a mess.
Well, mm-hmm. and one of the few where the story, as you were saying, is her
mm-hmm.
story.
Mm-hmm. It's her story, but she's also a character who can be irresponsible
right.
and be almost like one of the kids in the way that she
yeah.
relates to the rest of the family.
Grace
yeah.
Under Fire?
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a streak of sort of, interestingly enough, a bunch of them worked on by Chuck Lorre at some point or another, where they were comedies centered around female characters who had family. Grace Under Fire, mm-hmm. Roseanne, Sybil, the one that Sybil Shepherd was on, where she had
Sybil.
Kids and stuff like that. And those are all shows Chuck Lorre
mm-hmm.
worked on at one point or another, which is interesting since he then went in the direction of Two and a Half Men. And
right, yeah.
A bunch of stuff I have not cared for as much.
Well, it's interesting. There's a whole slew of shows which are centered around the man that turn the wife into the person who laughs a lot. Welcome back, Cotter. Marcia Strassman, his wife on that show, exists to laugh at his jokes and does nothing else. Never gets a storyline, never gets her own perspective. The same way, okay, Mork and Mindy were only married in the last season.
Oh,
but
boy.
They were married in the last season.
No, it's,
so it gets in on a technicality.
Gets in on a technicality.
She's the wife as straight woman.
I mean, she doesn't even set him up. All she does is laugh. It's an amazing. And when you go back and look at those things, it's like, wow, you're just here as a sounding board.
Yeah, it's true. I think originally, and I do want to mention another performance I really liked was Marion Ross in Happy Days.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Really one of my favorites as far as finding, again, that balance between, first of all, a lot of love in that relationship,
mm-hmm.
a lot of love in that marriage, a lot of believable, affectionate love in that marriage, including that was the first place that I, when I was growing up, heard the expression getting frisky.
There you go.
And they would talk about, they clearly had a sex life
mm-hmm.
that they acknowledged, even as parents,
mm-hmm.
which at that time was not perhaps as common as you would expect it to be now,
right.
in the age of, you know, Claire and Phil and Modern Family and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And they had a lot of affection, but then she had a lot of affection for her kids. They liked her. Their friends liked her.
Right.
She was sort of, you know, Fonzie's favorite.
Sure.
And so I love that performance as well.
Yeah, and the very first season of that show was single camera, and it was a hermetically sealed...
Yes, it was.
Time capsule of the 50s. It was very close to American Graffiti, which was inspired
right.
by.
Right.
As soon as you put that show in front of a studio audience, everything gets broader, looser. The 70s, the 70s sensibility,
right.
not just the styles and the fashions and the hairstyles, but the sensibilities start to creep in. And you get these speeches that Marion gives
mm-hmm.
about being taken advantage of or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you can just feel the audience. Now, this is kind of like Tyler Perry for white people, where some kind of thing is said that is geared to get this big, huge audience reaction.
Yeah.
It happens on All in the Family all the time. It
mm-hmm.
happens on shows like Good Times and
Designing Women.
Designing Women all the time.
Oh, Designing Women.
Oh, my God, all the time.
Yeah.
Now, that, because of the... That's something we're missing with the lack of the studio audience nowadays. We don't have that. I don't think people would still do that today.
Do yeah, you? I don't know that that's such a bad thing that that has fallen
I
out
know,
the
I know,
the
I
sort
know.
Of the...
Are you saying that the Julia Sugarbaker speech should not be brought back as a thing?
I remember there was a parody of that show on some...
Maybe oh, I bet there...
It was on 30 Rock.
Over time, there have been several, but there was one that I'm thinking of in particular where one of them would give a speech like that and the other characters would just stop and applaud.
Yeah.
Do we have any modern examples? Do we have anything? Can we talk about
decade? We've been talking about nothing but shows that were on when we were kids.
To be honest...
I mean, Modern Family.
Modern Family.
That gets
example.
Into
modern
that
family.
Scold versus Goofy guy.
Well, how about Linda on Bob's Burgers?
I have Linda on Bob's mm-hmm. Burgers right here. She's great.
Guess who got a job at Fresh Feed?
Check it out. That's what Mom will be doing at the checkout.
Yeah, paper or plastic, Mom. Am I right?
All right!
What? You got a job? But it hasn't come to that yet, remember?
I think what Mom's trying to say is, take this job and shove it, Bob!
Yeah, I'm bringing home the bacon now. Ha ha! Oh, I forgot to get bacon.
We have to go back!
Now, you want to talk about how much progress we've made. Of the three women on that show, two are played by dudes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can talk about... But that performance by CNN's John Roberts, actually. Did you know that?
No.
It's not CNN's. Sorry. Different John Roberts. But it would be awesome if it was CNN's John Roberts.
It's not
just
how stupid I am. I'm like, just,
really?
Well, for believing something that Glenn says on our podcast.
Yeah, it's right.
It's just so good. It's just so funny, and it's so specific. That's where the comedy lies. You don't need a studio audience going, woo. It's
right.
just fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny you mentioned men playing women on that show. Modern Family has the scoldy wife character in the Cam and Mitch relationship, and it's Mitch.
Oh, sure. That's
yeah.
Right. That's right. That's a good point.
And one of the things that I have talked about before that I like about Modern Family is that I've always felt that the Claire and Phil thing, which some people really do not like, that could very easily have gone in a very straightforward,
mm-hmm.
she's a nag, he's a goofball.
And it's much more than that.
And it is much more than that. And it's more nuanced than that. And they're not afraid to have her also screw up and be dumb
mm-hmm.
and do things she shouldn't do and be foolish and have him have a big heart and sometimes pull the save out at the last minute.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. We've talked about this before at a little bit of length, but there's a connection, and maybe it's a crossed wires connection between Claire and Phil and Edith and Archie.
Go on.
No, I just think
continue
in the way that
you don't have anything to back that up.
No, in the way that one character humanizes the other and keeps the other character from becoming someone the audience can ever root against.
Right.
Yeah, okay. I think that's right. I think many couples in comedy
mm-hmm,
do that.
Sure.
How many family sitcoms are there right now?
Well, that's what I was going to say, is the family sitcom is not a hugely...
You would think people would be trying to emulate Modern Family, which is a hit and an awardsy.
I think there's been some of that, but...
Up All Night? I mean, they're new parents.
But that's gone now.
But it's gone.
And, yeah, there aren't a lot. It's not the most... The workplace comedies are much more
right.
Common.
What about dramas, like hour-long dramas, aren't there?
Well, we could go into a whole...
There are, but that's a whole...
Coach and Tammy
whole
Taylor.
Whole
and
we could talk
that's a whole different thing.
And if we're going to go there, I get to start with Life Goes On.
Oh, we're not doing that. Mr. I need to bring Patti LuPone into every
Patti
conversation I ever have. Got to bring Evita into everything.
I never bring pet things into conversation.
Yes, right. Exactly.
I have manfully not mentioned Jean Stapleton's turn as the nurse in Romeo and Juliet here at the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C. in 1994.
Well, you mentioned it now,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
So you've unmanfully
mentioned
it.
How'd that go for you? Okay with it?
All right. Well, you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us about the comedy wives and moms and other women. Obviously, we didn't delve very much into your Mary Tyler Moores and your Marlo Thomases and your single women of the classic sitcom. But
just those who define themselves by their relationship with a dude. The old-fashioned way.
But come and find us and tell us about the ones that have meant something to you, and I'm sure we will get back to the ones that meant something to us. Oh, wait, I also wanted to say, because we're talking about All in the Family, Wheezy Jefferson, also awesome.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And meant to mention her in the All in the Family part. Anyway.
And, you know, Maude.
Yeah. Absolutely. Oh, Maude. We could go on and on.
You know what? Let's just start.
Let's just keep going.
Let's just start listing again from the beginning. No, that's okay. Okay. So the other thing we were going to talk about today was we have talked before about comics in terms of books, but we were going to talk about comics in terms of strips, which we have not talked about nearly as much. Okay. So Glenn, you are a comic book person. Mm-hmm. Are you a comic strip person?
Not as much now. When I was a kid growing up, boy, they collected peanuts into these collections, go figure, that we traded in elementary school back and forth. We memorized them. We take them out of the library and then take them out again. Mm-hmm. As I got older, Doonesbury was the thing. I borrowed my brother's Doonesburys. Didn't understand a word about them.
I still don't really understand Doonesbury.
But what Gary Trudeau was doing was very, it set the archetype, basically, because for many strips that he would write, character A would say something at panel one, character B would say something in panel two, there'd be a pause in panel three, mm-hmm. and then both of them would say something in panel four. Mm-hmm. So almost the punchline is that pause, mm-hmm. because that's right. where the tension is.
Right.
And the panel four diffuses that tension. Mm-hmm. It's the comedy of deflation, mm-hmm. which Bloom County picked up on,
right.
which Foxtrot picks up on, which a lot of...
Foxtrot.
Yeah,
I like Foxtrot.
I like mm-hmm. Foxtrot, too. But that was seminal. Later on, it was Bloom County, of course. I went to a school for marine biology, a science school. We were all nerds, so you could tell by how many Far Side comics they slapped on a door, you know, who was inside, and the professors did, everybody did it. It was kind of how you reflected your personality. Calvin and Hobbes, of course, in grad school and college. I mean, that's the one that defines. And then, you know, nowadays, I'm still reading the Boondocks. I think that's very, very funny. Mm-hmm. Get Fuzzy is a comic I like. Pearls Before Swine.
Pearls Before Swine is funny.
Frank and Ernest is just dumb jokes. Dumb puns.
Frank and Ernest has been around all for like 70 years.
Yep. It's true. Frank, I was not expecting, that was a curveball.
I gotta say, all
Glenn was like, surrealism, Frank and Ernest.
It's like vaudeville.
Just give me a dumb pun.
Of course, you talk about influential Dilbert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, as far as strips that hang on doors and in cubicles and sort of reflect large
Yeah, there was a time you could not get away from Dilbert. As a matter of fact, the very first... This is an interesting piece of internet trivia. It's not that interesting. The very first place on the internet that I ever had my writing was a site of movie reviews that I wrote that mm-hmm. my friend set up for me that was like a subpart of his site, which of course had some long whatever GeoCities probably address or whatever. And
it had lots of tildes in it.
And the graphic, and the graphic on all that was on the page was like a list of the movie reviews and the triangle head lady from Dilbert. Wow. I have no idea why he put that on there, but the triangle head lady was me. Was my first internet identity, I guess. Nice.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, if you're a kid, the comics page is a magical thing. You can't imagine the Wall Street Journal. You don't understand the appeal of the Wall Street Journal. What is that for? Because the comics page is the thing you build up to. You're smaller. The newspapers were bigger back then, so it would fill your entire field of vision.
And the strips were bigger within the paper.
The strips were bigger. That's a very important point. And
I'm very old.
Yes. But do you remember the day? Because I remember this day, the first day you realize, I don't have to read every one of these.
Right. I don't have to read Prince Valiant.
I have never laughed at Fred Bassett.
Yeah. Mm. Funk you, Inkerman.
I am not going to read Fred. They should make an after-school special out of this moment because it's like the first step toward adulthood, toward thinking adulthood. And
you start to realize. You realize that there are strips that suck.
Yes.
And strips
it goes
that...
the other way, too. I mean, when you're a kid, Beetle Bailey is funny. Is Beetle Bailey still around?
Yeah, but they're also around.
When I was a kid, Beetle Bailey was funny. Hager the Horrible was funny. Mm-hmm. And then there's that moment where you discover.
Hey, man, Funky Winkerbean had
you discover
moments.
Zippy.
Zippy the Pennant. Mm-hmm. Sure. Right?
Mm-hmm. Sure. And you,
I thought you were
going to
say Ziggy.
That's kind of
enjoy
here's
Ziggy.
The thing. I have to confess. Most of the titles that, with a couple of important exceptions, Far Side, Outland, kind of thing. Most of the titles that Glenn mentioned are things that exist only in the periphery of life for me because I don't really look at newspapers anymore.
That is a point I wanted to talk about.
But there was a confession that, I don't know, the listeners may never forgive me for. I was a Garfield nerd.
Oh, no, there's nothing wrong with
Garfield
being a
nerd.
You're the one.
No, I was a huge Garfield nerd. Part of it was I was a cat nerd.
Right.
But Garfield started in 1978 when I was six. And my dad was a newspaper man. And actually, he would bring home these books of comic strips that had been submitted to the paper that they could simply cut out and paste up. And Garfield came in, and he used to use me as sort of a focus group for them. And I loved Garfield, and the Cleveland Press, long defunct Cleveland Press, ran Garfield in part because I was so hugely into it. This was back when Jim Davis even knew how to draw these characters, let alone drew them with his own hand, which hasn't happened in decades. But I was a huge Garfield nerd as a kid. But I think, Trey, you bring up the decline of newspapers and sort of how fewer households have a newspaper, certainly a newspaper that is sort of read
and handed around.
Handed around the way that they were in my household as a kid.
I think that's been a tough format to relocate from the physical newspaper.
There are webcomics, but you have to seek them out.
You have to seek them out. The thing is, newspaper funnies were one of those loose cultural connections things where you might be an enthusiast about one or two of them, but mostly you were just a consumer.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
And in order to seek out a webcomic, figure out where it is, go find it, go look at it, you really have to be an enthusiast now. So you might go find the Boondocks, if you still like it, or one or two particular ones. There are people who continued to watch the characters of For Better or For Worse until that ended. Mm-hmm. And there are certainly still plenty of people who get the newspaper. The idea that nobody gets the newspaper anymore is something that you believe when you spend too much time around people who are exactly like you.
Yes.
So there are still plenty of people who get the newspaper who look at Family Circus.
Right, mm-hmm. Sure.
Did you know that Mary Worth was still a thing?
Yeah. Oh, Mary Worth is still a thing. I think Brenda Starr is still a thing.
Rex Morgan, MD.
Judge
Parker.
MD is
Apartment
still a thing.
3G.
Yeah.
Do you guys know of the Comics Curmudgeon? Have you heard of this site?
No.
I have heard of it. Yeah.
This is, if you don't want to sort through the newspaper funnies or go find them online, and I'm talking purely about newspaper strips here.
Right.
He reads them for you and makes fun of them. It's joshreads.com. It is so good. It is consistently good. He takes particular delight in Mark Trail, which is a bananas
story. Mark Trail. I just remember those
Apartment
words.
3G, Mary Worth, Rex Morgan. I have it bookmarked because every day it's just a source of delight. He's very, very funny and very, very good at what he does, which is make fun of comics, which, you know.
Yeah, and I would imagine, I mean, there are strips that, like we talked about with Mary Worth and Rex Morgan MD, where they seem like they might as well be Gasoline Alley as far as how much they are in the conversation right now. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Foxtrot. Foxtrot is still a very, very well-liked strip, but so many of the strips we named as great classic strips all kind of seem to go away within a span of a decade or two. You know, Charles Schulz died, so there was no more Peanuts. Bill Watterson retired, so there was no more Calvin and Hobbes. Mm-hmm. You know, you go down, they don't do For Better or For Worse anymore. They don't do The Far Side anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And
Kathy's gone. Ack.
Wow.
Chocolate. Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of that enthusiasm has gone in the direction of web
right.
comics, but not ones that are done in the traditional newspaper format necessarily, but stuff like Hyperbole.
I was going to say Hyperbole and Half.
Yeah, this is something that was, I was just going to ask. There was something about print comics that was the marriage of character and story with a specific sensibility. And now you have these things. I'm wondering if there was ever anything before in the print era. You have things like The Oatmeal that are pure sensibility, right? It's less about character and story. It's mm-hmm. just about a sensibility applied to an idea.
Well, Far Side, non sequitur. I mean,
Far Side was not character and story. That was, except, you know, there were little stories in the sense that it's a story when you say the cows are all standing around talking and the car comes and they say car and mm-hmm. get down on their, oh, yep. gosh. You know, the thing about The Far Side, if I can slightly digress about The Far Side for a minute. The thing about The Far Side that I like and that I miss is that there were so many Far Side things that just kind of worked their way into the vernacular of my family yeah. and a lot of people I knew so that you had these things to refer to. Like the entire concept of animals secretly being smart was symbolized by those cows who are seen up on their hind legs standing around talking like they're at a cocktail party, and then they say car and pretend to be cows, essentially.
Right. Using one panel to tell an entire story, which is, as you know, Linda, is my favorite kind of joke, where one line tells an entire story.
Right.
Bummer of a birthmark, dude.
Oh, my God. The one where it's objects in mirror are closer than they appear, and it's just a gigantic eye.
There are certain, when I say that they became part of kind of our common language, you know, if you've ever had a dog, the joke about blah, 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 ginger, blah, blah, blah.
Seriously, I use that all the time.
And then you can apply that to people where you say, I think when I say this to him, all he hears is blah, 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 ginger. So if you've never seen that strip, by the way, it involves a person who is saying, here's what you say. Ginger, you're a good dog. You're a bad dog. Hey, Ginger, get off the couch. And it says what your dog hears. Blah, 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 Ginger, Ginger, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, very funny. And it's the same thing with a bunch of them. I mean, there's all kinds of, there were all kinds of things that just stood for other things that worked their way into
and
the
strips
way
that
my
were
friends
able,
and
strips that were able to pull off melancholy and nostalgia in certain ways. I mean, Peanuts or obviously Calvin and Hobbes, where you think of the, I've mentioned on the show that the last strip of Calvin and Hobbes just makes me blubber. Like we've discussed, many things do, but that's one of them.
No, but the last strip of Calvin and Hobbes is probably the only comic strip that ever made me tear up.
Many Garfields. Calvins.
You know, like the lasagna, you know, the pull of the lasagna stood in for so much of my own
needs. Existential crisis, Well, you know, many Calvin and Hobbes, I think, would make me tear up sort of out of emotion. Not as much as that last one. When Stephen described the last Calvin and Hobbes ever, I cried in the studio when we did that.
Part of it was the power of my reading.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's the power of your... Speaking of the pull of lasagna.
So one thing that's going away... One thing that's going away forever is this notion of having a sheet in front of you that has all these different, vastly different styles in one place. And the styles are really a big part of this because, I mean, Scott McCloud, who wrote a book called Understanding Comics, talks about how we respond to things. We feel attracted to these images the simpler they get.
Mm-hmm.
So, a smiley face has a certain basic primal appeal.
Right.
Kids get it. As you get more and more detailed and more photorealistic, we have a more intellectual response. And then there's that uncanny valley, of course, what happens when you get in that last little stretch between the very photorealistic and the actual human face. Weird things happen in there that make things kind of creepy.
Right.
But you would be scanning along the page and you'd read every high and lowest. It would never be funny, but you'd read every high and lowest because it was so clean and simple. And I never read, even though it was so up my street, I never read Prince Valiant because you just look at this thing and it's
so
too complicated.
It's so ornate and there's so much going on.
Or like the family circuses where the kid's going all over the neighborhood and I'm like, I can't even follow those dotted lines.
The family circus is made to appeal. I mean, like, that is like like kid crack. It just, eye goes right to it. You can't help but go to it.
Yeah.
I do want to throw out a recommendation in terms of comic strips and commentary on comic strips. You mentioned the Comics Curmudgeon. I want to throw out a specific comic strip. You know Tom the Dancing Bug by Reuben Bowling. After September 11th, he does this occasionally. He'll throw together this gigantic kind of page size cartoon in which he does blocks of comic strips. And some of them are recurring. And after September 11th, he did this absolutely amazing one that was one of the first things that made me laugh after September 11th. And one of them is like, "Oh, that boy." Mm-hmm. And it's a Dennis the Menace thing. But in the one panel thing, the caption was always, "Terrorists destroyed the World Trade Center, killing thousands."
Right.
And each strip, each like three-panel strip, would have, you know, sort of these setups, and they were commentaries on all these different kinds of comic strips, but the last panel was always "Terrorists destroyed the World Trade Center, killing thousands." It's an incredible, incredible piece. I'll find it online and we'll link to it.
We'll try to find that, yep. All right, well, you should tell us about your favorite comic strips on Facebook or on the blog in our comments section. We always are happy to hear from you. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
This is so obvious, and it's such log rolling, but by the time this airs, I'm hoping that most people will have seen it. Linda's smirking because she knows exactly what I'm talking about. It is a piece that we put up on NPR Music that I had nothing to do with. I was on vacation that week, but we recorded a Tiny Desk concert with OK Go. And the headline is OK Go, a Tiny Desk concert in 223 takes.
Move his arm, babe. Could be as bad as I talked about. Move his arm, babe. Could be before we can make it out. But when they say that all is lost, all is not lost.
The way it runs, it's almost like 200, well, we didn't use all 223, but it's like 100 vines stuck together, and they stitched the audio together so it's completely seamless, even though it is 223 performances.
Oh, is it? It's not all one. I thought the audio was all from one.
The audio is synced up with the...
You are kidding.
It is an unbelievable feat.
I just assumed it was like just any other video when you just... And it's the purely the video.
If you listen closely, the sound is different in all the different places. You have the ambience of the elevator.
Well, the ambience of the
hallway.
They did
the ambience of the hallway is different as they're moving through the hallway. All
right.
So what we did...
That's crazy.
And I say we, I was not there. I am not one of the like 20 geniuses behind this project. But they start out performing in front of the old Tiny Desk in the old building. They are eventually loaded onto a flatbed truck as they are performing the entire time. Then they are brought into the new building through the loading dock, up the elevator. There's a fantastic elevator joke.
Yes, there is.
And then they're moved into the new space in which they build the Tiny Desk behind them. And there's a million little NPR cameos. There are tons of little visual jokes where Bob and Robin are kind of teasing each other with their names mm-hmm. that hang over the Tiny Desk. It's a wonderful piece. I'm just super proud to be associated with it. OK Go, a Tiny Desk concert in 223 takes.
Wonderful.
Aren't you glad to be able to get that secret out now? Because we've all been sitting on it forever.
And
right?
It had been reported. Yeah. There was like a, I think it was a Washington Post article about NPR that had reported that this was happening. My mom has been asking me about it for months. But yeah, to finally have it out. And now all the Tiny Desk concerts going forward will have been recorded in the new building.
Wonderful. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
A little thing called popular culture is making me happy this week.
You're going to have to do better than that.
So I was away last week, and I was traveling. I was lucky enough, a friend of mine had tickets to the French Open and invited me to come along. So I was in Paris last week, and I was
complaining about your seats the entire time.
Complaining about my seats for the Roger Federer match. So one afternoon, I went across the Seine, as one does. I went across to pay a call on an author and friend of a friend and former NPR correspondent, Frank Browning. And on the way back, I happened to cross the bridge right in front of Notre Dame, where a group of Chinese tourists were getting the introduction to the cathedral. And they were getting the introduction in Chinese, obviously, and I speak English and a very little bit of French. But what I heard was the guide saying something about Notre Dame. And then this man in the tour group broke out into the strains of Maria, I just met a girl named Maria. And it was pop culture that made me understand what had just happened at that moment. The guide was explaining to the tourist that this cathedral, Notre Dame de Paris, is named for the Virgin Mary, Our Lady of Paris. And this man had made a connection to Mary and Maria and all of these other ideas. And it just, it hit home with me in the strangest way, the way we're all connected, and increasingly so in our era, by these things that are, it's the very definition of pop culture. It is what connects us to others through shared experience. And it was just a happy moment, and I wanted to tell you about it.
Okay, cool.
And then you ate a croissant.
I ate it. Actually,
and took a picture of it and posted it on Facebook.
It wasn't a croissant. It was a petit pain, and I bought a chèvre and a petit pain and ate it on a park bench.
See, here's the problem, Linda. You just encouraged him.
Yep.
You didn't think you were encouraging him.
All right. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Film came out last year called John Dies at the End.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is a B-movie. It is self-consciously so. Kind of maybe a little too much self-consciously so. It sets out to be schlocky. It sets out to... tell a story with... anytime somebody sets out to make a cult movie, there is the faint whiff of contrivance.
Sure.
And and the whiff of pot smoke, actually, is involved in this film. Clearly, I didn't enjoy it to the full extent it could be enjoyed. But it's directed by Don Coscarelli, based on a book by David Wong, who actually is Jason Pargan. And Don Coscarelli directed Phantasm. He directed Bubba Hotep. It will remind you of things like Repo Man and Tapeheads and Bubba Hotep, where plot threads go and then disappear and characters come in and out. And it's, you know, it's all about interdimensional drugs and interdimensional bugs. You just get the sense watching this film that the editor is sitting there and the director just kind of goes, nah, leave it in. That's the engine of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
No, sure, go ahead.
Yeah.
So I do recommend it, though. I had a lot of fun watching it. John Dies at the End.
Wonderful. Speaking of B-movies... What is making me happy this week?
I know what you're going to say.
What is making me happy this week? Okay, so a couple weeks ago, I discovered in the TV listings that Lifetime was going to have a movie called Deadly Spa.
Oh, here
now,
we go.
Now, Linda, you've seen it. What's it about?
So I immediately started to talk about it on Twitter with the hashtag Deadly Spa. But you should know, the hashtag is not actually hashtag Deadly Spa. It's hashtag Deadly Spa. And every time I tweeted about it, I heard it in my head as Deadly Spa. So this Saturday, it was finally on. And so I sat down and I watched Deadly Spa. So the basic idea of Deadly Spa is it's a spa, but it's secretly a cult. Oh. And the bearded dude who owns the spa is secretly just kind of keeping people there and killing people just because he's just creepy.
This is the clientele or the staff?
Well...
Don't say it's complicated.
It appears that the staff is the people he's already
recruited,
come to own.
Right.
And the visitors, it seems like he only keeps some of them, like many times.
And the other ones leave terrible Yelp scores.
It just depends on he seems to sort of only take an interest in certain people. I can't say the plot is terribly well fleshed out, but it has various things in it, such as almost dying by being cooked in a sauna.
Sure.
As you expect to see.
Yeah,
deadly.
That makes sense.
That's the only
suffocation
real...
via face
seaweed
wrap.
That's
the only pure deadly spa kind of thing
no
that
rocks.
Happens.
I figured there's hot rocks involved.
Nobody gets hit with hot rocks. Nobody gets wax, hot wax poured on them.
Nobody gets salt scrubbed to death.
Right.
No, nobody gets salt scrubbed down to a tiny nub.
Oh, they needed to bring in some writers.
I was going to say that we could punch this thing up.
But the thing that was wonderful about this experience and the reason it made me happy is that I discovered there's a little community of people that watches Lifetime movies and talks about them on Twitter, and some of them are very, very, very funny people.
As you would expect.
At least one or two of my friends were like, "Well, I guess I'm watching Deadly Spa now because you were tweeting about it."
Well, this was the thing. The thing that was so funny about it to me is you would sit there, and clearly this is a thing they do regularly, judging by the one who said, "I think this is my favorite Lifetime movie since the Neve Campbell Amish one." So everybody really loved it, and I really loved it, and I wrote about it today, but you should just understand that the movie Deadly Spa is about a deadly spa.
Okay.
It ever comes up on your TV listings and you see Deadly Spa and you think, I wonder what this is about.
Right.
A, it's about a deadly spa.
Right.
B, you should get drunk and watch it.
Okay.
And that's what's making me
awesome.
Hi, Mom.
And scene. Yeah.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of our show. Thank goodness. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker.
There might be a few pictures of Paris there.
So don't follow Trey. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here, as always.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.